and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us on Alaska Public Media as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, we're hearing Alaskans tell surprising, touching, and interesting stories of leadership. We'll hear from various speakers as they tell their side of what leadership means to them and how they try to carry that forward. This event was called Here and Now 907, was hosted by the Alaska Humanities Forum, and took place on June 21st at Anchorage Community Works. Chris Palmatier starts us off as the Master of Ceremonies.
So I want to bring up Cameron Perez Fildia, over there with the Alaska Humanities Forum. He is the president and CEO, and if you can come up here, go up those stairs.
Hi, everyone. So when I'm about a year and a half into this position, and when I started at the Alaska Humanities Forum, the thing that they'll all laugh at is I was struggling with the word humanities. Because as I would talk to people throughout the community, and I would say Alaska Humanities Forum, and they would say, humanities. Is that that class I took when I was in college? I'm not sure what that is. And so it was a bit of a journey for me to find what that meant, not only to me, but to this organization. And the journey really has come to that, you know, the humanities are really at their core stories. That the stories of our lives, of human experience. They're the stories of our past, they're the stories of today. And there's no important story that's more important than another. All of our stories are important. And at the Alaska Humanities Forum, what we do with the humanities, those stories, as told through art, through film, through literature, through history, through lots of different forms, we use those stories, and we use them to connect Alaskans. We use them to teach, to inspire, to bridge differences. We use them in so many different ways. So essentially what we do at Alaska Humanities Forum is we bring communities together and we try to connect them in many different ways. And that in many ways is done through our education and youth programs. It's done through our public programs that have all kinds of different themes like Duty Bound, which is focusing on veterans. Our work around human ties that is looking at vulnerability and isolation and homelessness. Or our cross-cultural work that is looking at bridging people from all different cultures. But it also resonates so true in this room tonight, in our leadership programs, in Leadership Anchorage, that's really about bringing community together, diverse community, to engage and to experience and to learn together. And out of that has blossomed somewhere in the area of 350 alumni over the last 20 years, who work from all sectors of Alaska and who now serve in leadership positions all over our state. So that's what we do, is that we bring Alaskans together, and ultimately what we believe is that that work will strengthen our community, that we will be stronger as a state, we will be stronger in each of our communities, and that our state will be better off because of the work that we do. So that's who we are. And I hope that you will take some time to check out our website and to learn more about the work that we do. But tonight is really about stories and stories of leadership and a celebration of this amazing program that is celebrating its 20th year. So with that, I'm gonna end and move on to the really good part of the show, and that's the stories. Thank you very much for your time.
So yes, this is our project that we had for LA20. It was a Leadership Anchorage event. Me, Heather, Xavier, and Tara Nova were all together, and we kind of came up with this storytelling event that we'd like, that StoryWorks and Alaska Humanities Forum came up for us as a project. And we were trying to figure out how to find leaders in a community for storytelling. It was very challenging because from my position where I know things, I know a lot of leaders up in higher level leaderships, and we didn't want to go that route in some ways. We wanted to kind of find leaders in our community where they're leading somewhere. They're not acknowledged as much, which is always kind of great, you know, because, you know, behind the scenes, that's where I started as a dancer. Behind the scenes, you don't see me, you see the dancers. There's a lot of work behind the scenes, and a lot of these storytellers you'll be hearing from, you know, they do a lot of work, and you get to hear their stories today. So we have our first storyteller. Her name's Annette Alfonsi. If she wants to make her way up here, she'll be talking a little bit about her story. Like I said, we are all acknowledging that these are wonderful stories. So if you can, put your hands together for Annette Alfonsi.
Hello, everyone. My name is Annette, and in 2012, just to jump into it, I was a passenger in a rollover car accident, and now I have a mild traumatic brain injury and other internal injuries, but you wouldn't know it from looking at me. I was laid off one business day before I would have qualified for medical leave at my work after being told that I wouldn't be laid off. Thank you for that. I appreciate that sound. I saw a specialist with TBI across the door, and the first thing they said to me was, if I didn't lose consciousness, I can't have a brain injury in the 21st century. And I said, that's not the way brain injury is measured anymore. And they said, well, what article is that from? And a week later, they called me back and they said, actually, I double checked. I checked with someone and you're right. You can have a brain injury even if you didn't lose consciousness. And I just wanted to let you know I looked it up. And And I said, oh, well, thanks very much. I really appreciate that. But they did not update my permanent medical record. And so disability actually used their chart as one of the reasons for my denial, saying that I was fine. I've been in a 2-week time period described as a healthy, well-fed Caucasian female complaining of back pain, looking for pain management options, and an obese black female in no apparent distress seeking medication. And like, I can tan as well as the next person, but I'm not that good. So I've been told I look fine, so I should just get to work. I've been told I'll never dance again. I was told I needed to take a neuropsychological exam to justify speech therapy, but when I tested within normal, they said I was fine and I just needed anti-anxiety medication. And when I said, well, speech therapy helped me, they said, yeah, but it's expensive and somebody has to pay for it, so we can't recommend it. So I eventually got it and it helped a lot. But all of this and more, three of us kind of started a social support group, a young adult social support group for ourselves, realized we'd seen the same doctor, and he told each of us separately that he'd never seen anyone else who had described the same symptoms, and all of us had described the same symptoms. So all of this and more led to so much pain and crying and frustration and anger. And then I met an international researcher who I introduced to my physical therapist, taught her a new assessment technique, and she updated her entire clinic, and we started seeing some amazing changes, and I finally started having some hope, and that was awesome. And then a traumatic brain injury specialist moved into town, Dr. Murphy, and I got the back surgery I needed in Seattle, and my brain fog went away, and I started working part-time, and I felt like I was finally living and not just surviving, and that was awesome. And then Dr. Murphy and my physical therapist both said that they would be leaving the state at the end of the year, and I started freaking out because I didn't know what I was going to do. So a group of us, kind of in this social support group, started meeting more regularly, and we didn't know that we were all seeing Dr. Murphy. And one of us asked what we were going to do after she left, and all of us just burst out crying because we didn't know what we were going to do. We just knew that we couldn't go back to where we had come from. We'd come so far in such a short time. And so I talked to Dr. Murphy, and I said, why aren't you doing education before you leave? Like, nobody even knows the medication that we're taking. Like, I can't even get my meds refilled. And she said, I'm willing to do education. I've been asking people to do education, I'm nervous, and I just need someone to plan the event. And I said, oh, is that it? I can do it. Like, the worst thing that'll happen is that nobody will show up and we'll take you out to breakfast and we'll say thanks for everything. Like, the best thing that'll happen is 50 people will show up and then you can teach people about stuff and I can get my meds refilled. It'll be great. And she was like, sure. Like, that's worth the risk. So talk to the education person at the hospital, get the continuing education credit application for physicians and nurses, and that way they can get credit for coming. They have a reason for coming, so it'll count for their license. And I was like, awesome, tell them I'm coming. And she was like, yep, we'll do. And I was like, so what do you say about this? And they said, no. So I went to other institutions, multiple institutions that have experience with continuing education for physicians and medical providers, and they all said no. But funny enough, individuals said yes. So the Alaska Multiple Sclerosis Center that I was volunteering at said, well, we're looking at education. We don't know what we're doing. You're doing all of the work. Like, watching you will help us learn for next year. So yeah, like, sure, it can go through us. And the next year they had an MS summit, which was really great. And we finally found somebody to pay to do the physician credits, but the other applications I just did myself after multiple institutions said, well, we are very busy, like, we can't do this. And by the way, nobody just does this as an individual. You can't just do it, but I did it. So Thanks. But I got a call from somebody who said, so I learned about this event. Are you looking for a grant? I'm the grant person. And I said, oh, no, I was calling to invite you to the event. And he said, oh, this is something that we actually could really get behind. Would you like a grant? And I said, oh, yes, I would, yeah. And so we were able to film it. And so it's actually on YouTube now for free for anybody who wants to look it up. In October of 2015, Dr. Amy Murphy and Marie Smith, physical therapist, post-concussion and brain injury assessments and treatments. And people really liked it. Patients came, we made it low cost. A patient in Fairbanks actually paid for a couple of therapists to come down to Anchorage so that she wouldn't have to keep flying her daughter into Anchorage every week. She said she looked for a year for a therapist that was willing to learn from Marie Smith. And so it was really great. And they said, so when's the next one? And I said, we will never do this again. we had over 100 people, and we had lunch donations and door prize donations, and it was amazing. And I said, I will never do this again. And so I did it again in 2017. And an organization this time asked me to help them plan a TBI conference. And it was so much easier this time. And nobody said I couldn't do it because I'd already done it. And we had a budget and I got paid for it and it was great. And so it felt really good because patients once again said thank you so much for doing this. And providers with credentials disclosed that they also had brain injuries and said thank you so much for showing that the people that look fine might not also be fine. And essentially, thank you for taking that risk that I'm not taking. And so this was really like great successes that came directly from pain, you know, and directly from fear and anxiety. And the thing is that pain doesn't go away, in large part because I've been told that I should not advertise certain things to certain folks because of internal organizational politics. I've been told, no, that people will not work with me, that no, we won't work with you, but could you please advertise to your people about this event that I'm doing over here? I've been told that I can't participate in an online event for providers, essentially because I'm just a patient. So I could plan an event with an organization to get credits for doctors for their license, but I could not attend an online event for those providers because I'm just a patient. And so having these labels just arbitrarily attached and removed and having my abilities, you know, and other people's perceptions change because of their convenience or organizational politics or whatever it is, it's so frustrating. And I'm more than just a patient, I'm a person. I'm a capable person. I'm disabled, yeah, but I'm also I can also contribute. And that contribution might look different for me than it does for somebody else, but I still have value and I'm not just a patient, I'm not just this label. And so I can feel really helpless when that happens. And so I could, you know, complain about that for a couple of more minutes, or I could I could take that energy and channel it into a different project. And so that's what I did. So I took on the Unmasking Brain Injury Project, a shameless plug now. It's an ongoing project. It's an international project that was started out of North Carolina, and it's open to anybody with any type of traumatic or acquired brain injury to make a mask with an explanation of their art to share what it feels like to live with a brain injury. And so you can look it up by state and very soon by country and see people's stories from around the world. And so nobody from Alaska had reached out to them before I did, and I sent in my mask. I can't remember who contacted who first, and I brought the project to Alaska. And so we're working with different individuals who make masks or organizations that want to host a mask-making event and get their name on the project, or whoever just might be interested in bringing it to their area of Alaska. And nobody can say that we can't because we're doing it. And so, a lot of patients are doing amazing things around the state and around the country, and you might not know that they're patients because they might not have disclosed, or they just might not have a forum like this to be able to share what they're doing, but there are so many of us that are doing amazing things, and we just don't have a platform because the institutions, you know, aren't interested in what just a patient can do, but really we're the ones that are more motivated. Like when the grant money runs out and somebody else works on a different project, I'm still gonna have a brain injury, right? So I am really motivated for this to succeed. And so I'm really thankful to my family and friends who have basically never made me defend or explain my roses or my thorns, to reference my mask, who know that I want to live, I don't just want to survive, and that's something that everybody can understand, that I don't want to live down to somebody's expectations, that every day I have to navigate the space between the dis and the ability, and I won't apologize for that. And so in the meantime, I'll just hope that doctors and institutions someday can maybe figure that out and invite us to be a part of those conversations. And otherwise, I'll just keep on planning it myself if I have to, and inviting other folks. And just like in 2015, it doesn't matter who says no, it matters who says yes, because you can still have the event based on who says yes. I'll just keep using my pain as fuel to turn it into something positive, and to end on a positive note, to end with the same thing that I ended my mask explanation with, there's always hope, and so we're not alone, and there's always hope, and so that's my story, so thanks.
So moving on to our next story, we have a special two-story kind of event. So I'll bring two of them up. We have Charmaine and Nirvana Ramos. Nirvana is an LA 8 alumni, and then Charmaine is an LA 2. So, I mean, we've got, and if you don't know LA Leadership Anchorage, we have alumni people. So these two are our Leadership Anchorage alumni. So I'll turn it over to you guys to share you guys' story.
Wasa iati, yeh na ayahat, kne kwan kwashka kwan ayahat, tis kit ayahat, taktetan yari hatsiti, yak dot kwan ayahat, shinuk yu hat duasak, hlingit hainak, Nirvana Ramos yu hat duasak, gleka hainak.
She added some new words to that. I'm like, that's not in the script I wrote this morning. So my daughter Chinook just gave her blanket introduction. Chinook said she is Raven Moiety, Copper River Clan, and from the Owl House. She concluded that she is the daughter of the sea pigeon. Allow me to explain. Blankets are matrilineal. That means we follow our mother's line. Raven Moiety is one of two social groups for blankets. The other half of the group is Eagle. The two main moieties are subdivided into clans and houses. Although we're matrilineal, we honor our fathers. Hence, included in our introduction is our recognition of our fathers. My father is Coho. If you know Tlingit tradition, language, and culture, or TLC, you would know my family is from Yakutat. You may even know that we're Tlingitized Athabascans. There is no mistake that Mount St. Elias Dance Group from Yakutat looks and sounds different from other Tlingit dance groups in Southeast Alaska. We brought our regalia with our family crest for you to see. I was born and raised in Southeast Alaska. As with tradition, my siblings and I grew up at the feet of our maternal grandparents, grandaunt, and uncle, learning Tlingit TLC at the village. They taught us, and I apologize, I was traveling all of week, so I have to read this. They taught us by allowing us to play, to watch them at work, to play, to ask them questions, to play, and then to practice what they're doing. Tom Sawyer had it on us because we got to whitewash the fence white, and we were told we were doing a great job, so let's do it again, is what my grandparents said. My recollection of these summers is pure joy. If anyone had spent time with their grandparents, who are responsible to teach you, you know they do it with love. I served as the assistant manager for recruiting for the 2010 census. I managed more than 120 employees during this two-year period, including 35 recruiters stationed in the regional hubs and in Anchorage. They traveled statewide to recruit and to test interested individuals for employment during the decennial of housing and population. For communication and coordination purposes, I held weekly teleconferences for the recruiters. The weekly agenda was very simple. It had three reoccurring items. One, I provided information to them that they needed to do their job. Two, they reported challenges and requested ideas or solutions to these challenges. And three, they spoke to each other on lessons learned and to encourage each other. As time went on, a recruiter volunteered to facilitate the weekly teleconferences. Instead of me giving ideas and solutions to individual recruiters' challenges, they started helping each other. Their feedback to me was they enjoyed the teleconferences because they were in charge, and they learned a lot from each other. I'm such a proud parent. Again, I'm working for the census, but this time as the partnership specialist. I'm tasked with getting the word out to local and tribal governments about preparing for the 2020 census. I'm currently responsible for the states of Alaska, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. We are promoting two preparatory geography operations that occur this and next year. I'm meeting with city and tribal staff to promote one of the operations, the 2020 Local Update of Census Addresses Operation, or LUCA, for support. The LUCA operation occurs once every 10 years for only 120 days. The government employees are asked to review their list and maps of addresses and make necessary changes. I know both parties have a lot to gain by communicating and coordinating efforts to create the foundation of a decennial, that is, current and correct boundaries and addresses within those boundaries. However, much to my dismay, not all government employees are excited about the 2020 LUCA operation. Sad face emoji here. At first, I poke them, I jump, and I wave. And I say, this is a great idea, but they do not budge. So now, after months of meeting with and promoting the LUCA operation to other government employees, I'm learning how to let go during these meetings. Now I just email reminders of their opportunity to participate in the 2020 LUCA operation and hope they decide to participate in the 120-day operation. This type of leadership is difficult and challenging for me. It's hard to let go. This is my career leadership challenge today.
As it says in the program, I am currently the senior trainer for the Training and Development Department at ANTHC, the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and in partnership with the South Central Foundation, we're the ones that run the Alaska Native Medical Center. I'm an instructional designer, so I develop instructor-led and online training that assists our staff, both ANTHC and South Central Foundation, in developing their own personal and professional development. For the past 3 years, I have worked on and run our Alaska Native American Indian Leadership Development Programs. We have three of them. The Alaska Native, I have to look this one up. This is where I actually do. Even after 3 years of running, it's hard to remember all of the initialisms and acronyms. So ANELP is our first one, and it's the Alaska Native Executive Leadership Program, which is our postgraduate certificate program in partnership with Alaska Pacific University. We have a graduate program, LEAD, which is Leadership Excellence Through Determination, where our staff earn 5 credits toward their MBA at APU. And then we have our entry-level program, which is Pathways to Leadership, where our staff can start working on expanding their abilities to be supervisors or managers. I've utilized my networks within ANTHC to identify the best subject matter experts. So this is really our version of Anchorage leadership, is finding these experts, delivering that in-depth knowledge, and working with our cohort participants. I have personally developed and delivered a lot of the professional training for them as well. Recently, I started developing my own small business, TISC HIT Knowledge. It allows me to continue to do the type of work I enjoy, helping individuals develop personally and professionally, and to start becoming my own boss. Now, who remembers me saying TISC HIT earlier? Kind of, maybe. It was part of my introduction. TISC HIT means, in Tlingit, owl house. With the word knowledge, I wanted to use it as improving your personal and professional self is how I'm moving forward as a leader in our community. Thank you.
It's always nice to hear about the alumni from Leadership Anchorage and where they are now. And so you got to actually experience that just now. These are Leadership Anchorage alumni 2 and 8. So we're in 20. That's, you know, I'm not going to count the years. You know, don't want to out anybody, but it's been a while, so thank you. So moving on to our next storyteller, we have Brian Walker. He has a unique story about leadership in a certain way, so I'll let him give that story up. Thank you so much.
Hello and good evening. Well, my name is Brian Walker. My mom is Laurie Chase from Anvik, Alaska. So my story is a little bit different than those tonight. So back in 1834, the Russian fur traders made their way up the Yukon River. And with them, they brought 3 pandemic flus. Over the years, it really decimated a lot of Alaska Native people, really killed off a lot of people. My great-grandma and grandpa were living in Iditarod when my great-grandma caught tuberculosis, and she ended up dying. My great-grandfather had 5 children at the time, and he couldn't take care of them. And to back up just a little bit, Alaska, when the pandemics came through, the 4 major religions decided that they wanted to split Alaska up because they didn't want to fight over their souls, all these people were dying. When the flu went through Alaska and it killed a lot of people, they decided that they needed to build a mission in the Anvik area. So back in the early, about the mid 1920s, they built a mission house. The mission house was about 40 feet by 100 foot by 2 foot, I mean 2 stories, log cabin where all the children were sent. And so when the families would die off, they needed a place to send all these children. And so a lot of the, like I said, the families all died. Sometimes just the children were left. And so they were sent to the Anvik mission. When my great-grandma died, my great-grandpa needed help. And so he gave 2 of his children, my grandma and my great-aunt, to the Anvik mission, and my aunt, my great-aunt, to the Holy Cross mission to be raised. My grandma was... She took care of a lot of the patients that were there and dying from TB and from polio and from flu. Skip forward a few years, actually about 20, 30 years. When I was a kid living back home, I was told of stories of the mission house on how it was haunted. People would hear things walking and no one would be there. People would see things moving. And so as a child, I kind of snuck around it. I didn't really go in there because it was haunted. It was, you know, it was a place to be avoided. Next to the mission house was the missionaries' house. That's where the priests lived. They had their own quarters where they lived. And sometimes when people would go to Anvik, they would stay in either place. Skip forward about 40 years. I went back to Anvik to help my grandpa run his general store there, and I ended up staying in the missionary's house because there was nowhere else to live. My grandma and grandpa had a small house, and they figured, well, I could stay there by myself. I was in my late teens when I went back there. See if I can get this in there. And so I stayed in the missionary house, and there's a little bit of stories about the house. And I never really thought of it. I was in my late teens, staying there by myself. And so one night, I had a dream, and I was laying in bed. And in my dream, I woke up because I heard something out in the living room. See, the house, when you walked in, you walked into the living room, and then there was a hallway down. There was a kitchen, and there were three bedrooms. So I was in the back bedroom, sleeping. And in my dream, I woke up because I heard something. I was like, what is that? You know, I'm the only one here. What's that sound? And then it made it again. And I was like, what is going on here? You know the hair on your arms? You know how it stands up and the back of your neck, it kind of stands up when you kind of sense something? Well, I lay there and I was like, oh God, this isn't happening, you know. And then all of a sudden, it kind of sensed that I was awake. And it made another sound. And then I just kind of went, whoa. And then it started laughing. Ha, ha, ha. You're scared. And I'm like, whoa, this is not happening. And so I kind of sit up in my bed. Because I'm not afraid of anything. Maybe a bear. A bear I'm kind of scared of. I have a lot of respect for a bear. I've seen what they do. And so I kept walking back and forth, kind of taunting me to even come to the door. And again, I went, no, I am not afraid. I'm a native man. I'm a healthy native man, and I'm not afraid of anything. So I walked up to the door, and again, it just kept that sinister laugh. I reached and opened the door, and as I opened the door to confront it, it went downstairs into the basement. See, downstairs, when you open the door, there were 12 steps down to a mud floor. And so I opened the door because I'm going to confront this. I'm not going to be afraid of it. I'm a healthy native man, and this is not going to get the better of me. And when I opened the door, it went downstairs, down to the basement. And it kept laughing at me. It kept saying that I was afraid native boy, that I would never amount to anything in my life. And so again, the hair stood up. You know, when it went downstairs, I was like, oh my God, you know, this is scary. You know, the hair in the back of your neck kind of stands up. You know the feeling, right? We've all had it. So I walked down. As I was walking down the hallway, it kept laughing. It kept trying to convince me that I was scared. And I kept telling myself, no, I'm not scared. I'm going to do this. And so I walked down the hall and went and opened the door. And when I was opening the door, I was like, what are you doing? This is stupid. You're the only one here. So I opened the door, and it kept laughing, and it was walking just out of sight. You see, again, when you look down the hallway, down the stairs, the light just shined down to the bottom step. There was no other light. You had to go downstairs in order to turn the light on. And so I was, again, I kept saying, no, I can do this. I'm a strong, healthy, native man. And so when I opened the door, it seemed to laugh a lot louder and a lot. It kept taunting me, that sinister laugh. I'll just never forget that. And I opened the door, and as I was walking down, I started saying the Lord's Prayer. And I said it all the way down to the bottom. And when my foot hit the bottom, it stopped. And that's my story.
Thank you.
You are listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. We've been hearing from Alaskans as they tell stories of leadership. This event was titled Here and Now 907 and was hosted by the Alaska Humanities Forum at Anchorage Community Works on June 21st. We return to Chris Palmatier for our next introduction.
So we have our fourth storyteller. We have Steve Lindbeck, if he wants to make his way over. He has an awesome story to talk about leadership. He is, well, from the beginning of Leadership Anchorage, he's the one that's got it started. So I'll let him explain that story.
Thank you. This is a huge treat for me to be here tonight for the 20th anniversary, part of the celebration of Leadership Anchorage. My name is Steve, and I'm a humanist, just as all of you are humanists. The way we organize our lives, I believe, is by narrative. We tell stories. We tell stories through history and literature and philosophy and oral histories and films and research and book writing and all the ways in which the humanities help us encounter who we are as human beings. And the humanities are really essential to all of us. We're all humanists, and I'm very pleased to see so many people here tonight from different walks of life and different parts of our community that are here to celebrate Leadership Anchorage, because it's one of my babies. I'm really proud of it. It was about 1996. I resonate, by the way, with Cameron's talk earlier, because I had his job many years ago, and I used to try to explain the humanities to people. And we all know them because we all do them all the time. We just don't seem to like the word very well. But anyway, this RFP, Request for Proposals, from the Pew Trust came across my desk one day, and it was to create a leadership development program to bring diverse communities into leadership positions in communities in our country. And I said, we need this for Anchorage. Now, there are many leadership development programs around the state and around Anchorage now, but there weren't then. It wasn't so, and I really appreciate the stories of the programs that are in existence now, and there's many different kinds, but there weren't any then. And I looked around and I began gathering people and forming committees and starting having leadership lessons about how we would start this thing in our town. And magic started happening. And it was a great experience to help pull all that magic together and to see it grow and learn and change over time. But for me, there was another beginning to the program, and that was 10 years earlier. I was a newspaper editor before I was the executive director of the Humanities Forum, and one of the great opportunities I had was to get a fellowship at Stanford University, one of the great institutions of higher learning in our world, and to spend a whole year there and just have free run of the university and take classes in any department that I wanted. And there was me and another dozen journalists that had that opportunity. And I found myself gravitating to the business school, one of the best business schools on the planet, and very, very smart people there. And I took courses, and there was one that attracted me a great deal. It was a course in leadership, and it was a course in leadership through the vehicle of the humanities. The professor was a man named James March, who just a few years ago was described by The Economist magazine as the guru to the gurus, one of the smartest people ever. And he taught courses that you'd expect at a business school, like organizational behavior and economic psychology and statistics and computer simulation. But he also taught courses like the rules for killing people, or friendship, or, in my case, leadership. And he used humanities texts to do that. So for my course, I remember we read the Robert Caro books on the origins of Lyndon Johnson's career. We read George Bernard Shaw's book about Joan of Arc and how a teenage woman became a revolutionary leader for all of France. We watched the Henry Fonda version of the movie 12 Angry Men about how a jury could be changed and turned by positional authority and influence in a room. And it was a magic time. And I realized that these were the stories that tell us how to be leaders. And it was a very, very effective course. And for me, 10 years later, when this RFP came across my desk and the Alaska Humanities Forum set out to start Leadership Anchorage. It was the culmination of something that I'd seen as very special for myself and whose lessons I had applied. So here we are now, 20 years later. The original program was formed with a grant from the Pew Trusts. We were one of 12 communities in the country that received one of the original grants, and we were very proud of that. And in the second year, we thought, well, we'll apply again. And they had a different committee that judged the grant proposals. And we got a second grant. And then the people who were running the program, who hadn't been part of the committee, said, oh, we didn't know we were going to give you two grants. But they were so happy with the program, and we were too. It was such a treat that we got a chance to do it 2 years in a row. So the first year of the program, I remember, we were trying to bring people of color and people from across the different aspects of our community into leadership roles. And we had some great experiences. We actually made a deliberate decision that we were not just going to find emerging leaders, but that we would pick people who were from across the spectrum of leadership. Newcomers, but also people with a lot of experience, so that each of them in the spectrum could learn from each other different kinds of lessons. And it worked out really well. In the first year we had, I remember, Janie Leisk, who was a leader at Alaska Federation of Natives, and she told the story of Alaska Native land claims. Many of the people in the program didn't know anything about it. It was really special. We had a fellow who I recall, he was 6'11" tall, and he was a jazz pianist. And he came as a consultant, and he taught courses, and he brought the group to a string quartet and had them observe how teamwork works in music and how important and rich the improvisation and the excellence and also the standards were for people to operate in a quartet. So it was a very rich program, and it has evolved in many, many directions ever since then. I am so, so thrilled each year when I hear about the new cohort of Leadership Anchorage. We've had a debate more or less forever about when and if it should become Leadership Alaska, and it really already has. We just don't call it that yet. But there are people, as Cameron said, 350 people across Alaska who are doing magic, wonderful things, and who have contributed to our communities in ways that we cannot all even imagine, and who I like to think have helped make Anchorage one of the most diverse communities, ethnically and otherwise, in the United States, and have made it successfully so, at least by comparison with other places. So it's been a tremendous opportunity for people. I met a young man from class 19, raise your arm, who said to me just a half an hour ago, it has changed lives. And I know that has been true for the cohort members, and I know they're aware of that, and I also know that it's changed lives from other people around them in other organizations and other institutions. It certainly has for the Alaska Humanities Forum. I admit I had an ulterior motive in creating this thing. I wanted important, involved, creative, energetic people in Alaska, all across Alaska, to be introduced to the humanities in a formal way and to the forum as an organization that could help them. And by golly, I was right. They've done so. And so for me, it is really a treat. That first year, we touched a nerve. We actually created for ourselves a public relations problem. We had 200 applications for 20 places in the program. And we were so excited when we saw this pile of applications and all the really amazing qualifications of people. And we were excited choosing and picking who could be in the program. And then we got done with that and we said, oh my goodness, we have to tell 180 people that they can't be involved. And that was not easy to write that letter, I have to tell you. But I know that many of them got involved in subsequent years and that it has been a really tremendous program. So thank you to all of you in the room who've been part of Leadership Anchorage. The storytellers you saw here already are the best illustration I could think of for the power and the wonder of the humanities. And I believe that the humanities are very deep in our hearts, in our minds. We all use them all the time. And this program has been, I am proudly joyful of what it has been able to accomplish and what it will accomplish in the next 20 years. So thank you so much.
So before I bring on the next storyteller, I want to get everybody back in their seats, and I'm going to give a little one-minute storytelling since it is Pride Week. I figure I'd tell you a little coming-out story. It's kind of a fun little story for me. I have a very supportive mother and father. I got to actually come out to my father, and the first time I ever saw him cry. It's a very interesting, inspirational moment. He lies now and says he didn't. But we did cry together, and we did give a hug. My mother, on the other hand, I always thought she'd be more understanding in the beginning. And she wasn't as first. And what made me laugh is that one day, I never told her. I told my father first. We're driving, and I'll never forget the streets. We're on Arctic and Tudor in my mom's minivan. And I'm the one driving. I don't know why. And as we're about to turn, my mom stops in the middle of the conversation that we're having, I believe, about making gumbo or something for family coming up. And she looks at me, "Are you gay?" And I looked at my mother, and I'm like, "Yes, Mom." And we kept on driving. That was the end of it. It never got talked about again. So that's the story of coming out. Yeah. So we're bringing our next storyteller. It's Ken Miller. He's another Leadership Anchorage alumni, Leadership Anchorage Alumni 13. I believe I'll let him introduce himself. So please put your hands together for...
Sorry, Ken Miller.
Good evening. My name is Ken Miller, and I just want to say real quick up front, I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to share my truth. This is my story. This is my truth. The name of this story is A Dream Not Deferred. There's a very famous poem by Langston Hughes called A Dream Deferred, and the poem, he says very simply, "What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or does it fester like a sore and run?" And then he continues on to say, "Does it explode?" I know the consequences. I know the history. I know the experience of a dream deferred or a dream not believed in. And one of the things that I do as a leader is try to engender, promote, and inspire dreams in others, and especially African American men. That's what I do. And this is my story and how I got to that point in my journey. September 22nd, 2004, I was in Reno, Nevada, and I was arrested for the sales of a controlled substance. At that time, I weighed 160 pounds. I had a pair of sneakers. I had no socks. I had a pair of shorts. I had no underwear, and I had a tank top. That was the sole possessions I owned in the world. I was a homeless crack addict and had been that way for 15 years. I was sentenced to 6 years in the Nevada State Penitentiary. I did 3 years. I was not a leader in the penitentiary. I was not a leader in the streets. I was not a leader in the halfway houses, the recovery, or even in my first 3 to 4 years out of the penitentiary. In 2009, I had a gentleman named Jim Posey said to me, "Ken, I believe that Leadership Anchorage would be good for you. Why don't you give it a shot?" And one of the things that I had learned even in those few years out of the penitentiary, and I'd been to the penitentiary 3 times, I said to myself, I will take leadership, I will take knowledge, I will take information from another person because I trust that person. Because he has my best interests at heart, and I believed in Jim Posey. And so I started Leadership Anchorage, and I, at that time, was not an individual that particularly cared about nonprofits, cared about philanthropy, nor cared about helping another. There's a definition of leadership, and the definition is this very simply. A leader is an individual that inspires or engenders or supports another person's dream, a dream not deferred. And I said, okay. I did Leadership Anchorage. I got exposed to great individuals, I got exposed to strong leaders. I got exposed to knowledge. I got exposed to a reason to be a leader. But I still was not a leader. I was not a leader. Because, again, at that point, it was all about me, about getting myself back, getting back into the corporate world, getting back into feeling good and getting the ego and getting the self. But this is what happened. This is the day I became a leader. 3 months after I graduated from Leadership Anchorage, I get a call from a good friend of mine named Wanda Green with the NAACP. She said, Ken, why don't you come down to our award ceremony? We'll give you an award. I said, okay, cool. I'll come on down. Put the suit on, grab my wife. We go down there, and we're sitting at the head table. And I'll never forget, I'm looking at the program to see what award I'm getting. And at the program, I'm working my way down at the bottom of the program. It says the President's Award, Ken Miller. And Ken Miller will be giving a speech. Nobody told me that. My wife is laughing hilariously. I'm giving Wanda the mean eye. And so it was very interesting. They gave away all these awards, and it was all these youth awards. It's real important you hear this. There was a tremendous amount of youth awards, and it was about 5, 7, 8, 9 people walked across, youth, African-American young men and women, walked across. They got their awards. It was about 2 or 3 other awards, and then it was time for Ken to go up there and do this speech he didn't know he was going to do. And so I'm thinking, and I'm looking at these young men and women walk across the stage, and I'll never forget, I came up there and I said, my name is Ken Miller. I thank you for giving me this President's Award. But I want to do something. I want to put a charge out to this community. And it's the community of the African Americans that have been, quote unquote, successful in Anchorage. That's who it was. It was what we call the black bourgeoisie. And I looked out there and I said, you know, we've seen young men and women, teenagers, early 20s, but mainly teenagers, walk across the stage and getting awards. And the charge I put out to you is for you ladies to reach down to these young ladies that walk across the stage. Put your hand down and support them and help them in their aspirations and dreams. Men, I send the same charge to you to reach down and grab one of these individuals, men that walked across this stage, and support them in their aspiration and their dreams. And I said, and I looked them in the eye, I said, I'm going to do it. And I got off that stage, and I'll never forget this, at the Captain Cook, and I took that young man right there, Xavier Mason, I walked up to him, I did not know who he was, and I said, you heard what I had to say, can we sit down and talk? And he said, yeah, sure. And that was 6 years ago. That young man is going to Oxford to get his MBA. I'm going to tell you how this works. I'm going to tell you how this works and why I do what I do. At this time, I mentor and lead 18 young African-American men. 18. But I have 4 generations of black men helping black men. They are bringing now that next generation, and they're working with. But I'll tell you why I do what I do. There was a gentleman named David Carey. David Carey was the U.S. Olympic heavyweight boxer at the Beijing Olympics. He was the alternate. And I met him in the gym, and I came up to him, and I said, what are you doing? Because I see you training these young men. And he said, well, I have an organization called the Alaska Boxing Academy, and I work with at-risk youth, and I help out. I said, that's awesome. Let's sit down and talk. And I'll never forget this. This is so beautiful. I sat down with him across the table, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, what is your dream? And he couldn't articulate a dream. No one had given him permission to articulate a dream. No one believed in him to articulate and to explain a future that was just a picture in his mind. And I'll never forget looking at him, and I said, hey, I'm in no rush. Take your time. Money is not an object. Motivation is not an object. Resources are not an object. What is your dream? And he sat there, and we sat there for probably about 30, 45 seconds. And he said, well, if I could, I'd like to do this, this, and this. 5 years later, we've done this. We have a building. He's working with 20, 25 ex-gangbangers, kids from all over, bad backgrounds, broken homes, and he's working with those people now. His dreams have come true. And what I do is this. I support, I teach, I motivate, I inspire. But the most important thing is I look a man in the eye and I say, I believe in you. Broken homes, no father. You know, the parents, you know, having difficulties, maybe some chemical issues. But I'm going to tell you at the end, and I'm going to end pretty much with this. About 6 months ago, I sat down with David, grown man, ex-heavyweight boxer. And I sat down with David, and I said, how's it going? Where are we at? How's our plan? He said, Ken. And he had tears in his eyes. And the tears were of joy to see a dream that he wanted, to have his own facility, to work with young men and young ladies, to teach them the art, the skill, and the sense of being a part of a team. And he said, it's come true, man. And I just want to thank you for that. And, of course, I started crying, you know, because I so believe in them. And I believe in the Xaviers and the Jewels and the Sean Items and all the 18 young men that I work with today. What a beautiful thing I've been given. You know, my leadership is not leading a team at the job. It's about sitting down with one man to another and saying, I believe in your truth. I believe in your future. And I believe in your vision. That's been my gift. Thank you.
So we have our last storyteller, and she's going to make her way up. Her name is Laurence Evanga. I believe I might have it pronounced wrong, so I'll have her announce it last. I apologize. So please put your hands together for Laurence.
Ambolani. Manajuna Laurence Evanga. Manga biale Cameroon, monongono bulu. Manga standa biamimbu mumu saman, mumu by ami saman. Jometeja makumbo zuko wumi ava musu. Bonjour tout le monde. Mon nom est Laurence Z. Evenge. Je suis née au Cameroun, en Afrique. Je suis infirmière. J'ai été retraitée, j'ai travaillé 26 ans. Je voudrais partager avec vous ces moments. Merci. It's hard, right? It's how I feel when I moved here in America. I couldn't speak or write in English. I spoke 5 different languages in my home country, and I moved here 9 years ago, I joined Granby High School Adult Education, and I learned how to write and learn and speak English. I was born and raised in Cameroon, Africa. I am 26 years nurse retired. I speak French like my first language and other different languages. When I was in young, my father just teach us about education because he was a teacher high school. And he knew how important it was to go to school to have education. In my place where I live, girl didn't have enough to go to school. They didn't allow a girl or a young girl to go to school. They knew only one thing, marriage and have a kid. But my father, because he was a teacher, he said, no, all of you have to go to school because I believe on education. I was married so young, but I never forget what my father said, You have to work because your work will be your first husband. And I keep that in my mind. When I went to that marriage, it wasn't easy. I took my class exam for nursing school, and I passed my exam. I went to school 3 years, and I became a nurse. I was so happy. My parents were so proud of me because I have that knowledge. I started working. In the area where I was living, a young girl didn't have nothing. They were just mother and wife keeper. One day, one lady come to me. He came to me. She said, "I want 20 cents. I don't know how they here is like a 20 cents. She begged on me. She said, "What do you want to do with that cents?" She said, "I need matches. You know, I want to light down my fire, and I need something to buy matches." I give her. Then she went back. That thing, I feel so bad. I was so hurting that only 20 cents. She couldn't have only 20 cents. I said, "No, I have to do something about this girl. It's not right. How somebody stay at home? Even sense she don't have." I was thinking about how can I help those ladies. Then one day I said, "Okay, I have to do something." I start calling girls everywhere. I said, "Oh, go and call some ladies. Come with me to my place." The news went everywhere. And one day, one Sunday afternoon, I have 50 ladies in my house. And I said, "Oh, that's good." I create association, a woman association, and I named that Nkoledin. In my language means Friends Alliance. We start every month, we meet, we talk about everything, how to help other, how to love each other. We came together and every month we met and we was talking about everything. I created that group to help women, to empower them to take care of themselves, to be a role model for their kids, because they didn't know how to take care of everything. They was just abused for, you know, it's hard to say that, but men was abused to all those girls because they don't have no money, no work, and they abused to them. And I empower them in that group. I say, "We have to create something." We create a garden where we grow potato, tomato, every little thing, and pepper. That food was sold in a local market. That I bring that independence for women. I say, "We have to do something. Go to the marketplace and sell food, and you will have your own money." They say, "Oh, that's good." They love it. It's still going. Every time. With my knowledge and my nursing experience, I taught those women about parenthood, planning family, because every woman, I am a mother of six, and many, all of the girls who have 10, 12, 8, who doesn't have enough is 5. I said, "No, we better stop this. Parenthood, planning familial, come to the hospital. We have to stop those things." And the women, they were so happy that I teach them about to take care of themselves and their own kid. Those things were so good. And when we create that association, we was also helped a hospital, a prison, an orphanage. Because we have, I don't know how to call, we make a little money, we was a token. We call that token. Every woman brings something, then we join together, we go to the marketplace, buy soap, and we can share that thing to the hospital, we go to the orphanage, we share our little thing we have. It's how we was doing back in Africa. Then in 2009, when I moved here to Anchorage, I joined a community, Cameroonian community here, who I helped. I became in that group a treasurer and a secretary. Then I became a vice president in our group. In that group too, we promote our culture in Cameroon, Cameroonian culture, our value. We teach our kid and our grandkid our value, because it's not because we came to a big country, we have to forget how we live in Africa. In Africa, people don't have that opportunity to live like here. And we teach our grandkid, do not forget we always live together with our grandparents and parents. It's when you grow, you can go in your place, but don't forget where you come from. That's why you see me dressing like this. It's how we dress in Africa. Women have to be covered everywhere. And we also have in this community here in Anchorage, we help people in Cameroon with any kind of donation. Sometimes we sell high glasses, we beg or we ask. If somebody have, we can collect and help people back in a Cameroon. Something who just made me happy was that 2 years ago, I went back to Cameroon. Then I asked about my community, my association I created. I asked how the thing was going. One of the lady called me. She said, oh, mom. They call me Mama, Mama Laurence. It's how they call me in Cameroon. She said, Mama Laurence, I have a good news for you. I said, what good news? She said, I have my own place in a marketplace now. I said, what? She said, yes. Oh, you teach me about independence. Now I have my own place in a marketplace. I sell everything. You see, I put myself wing and I can fly everywhere now. I said, wow. I was so happy that only even one girl just took what I have teaching them today. Thank you again. Merci.
Can bring to the stage Kitty Farnham.
I'm going to close it down and not tell much of a story, because really the stories have been told. Another hand for those fantastic stories of leadership. Leadership, courage, and giving back across our community in so many different ways. I want to invite Lolly. Lolly Karpluk, where are you? There you are. Lolly's our board one of our board members for the Alaska Humanities Forum. And we're delighted that she's here tonight to share a couple words. Lolly came down from Fairbanks. She was so enthusiastic to be here. She came to our kickoff for the 20th cohort just 9 months ago, 7 months ago, whenever it was. November, whenever that was, and that energy carried forward, and she said, I really want to be there tonight, so let me give you this over to Lolly.
Goyana, huinga yuktun atka atjakalagawuk, kwikpag mingungulo azajakyakamuk. This is a very brief introduction in Yupik, where I'm from. Atjakalak is one of the many Yupik names I was given as a newborn, which is after my mother's oldest brother's wife that had passed on when I was born. And there's a lot of stories connected to that, our Yupik names. Azajakirak is a Yupik name for mountain village. And Kwikbag Mingungulo, I am from the region of the Big River. And the Big River is in reference to the Yukon River. 2,000 miles originating in Canada and all coming all the way down, cutting the state in half. And my home is 60 miles from the Bering Sea, as you come up from the Bering Sea up the Yukon. And there are about, I want to say, 15 villages all up and down the Yukon. And as each of the storytellers shared this evening, I could connect to each of them. And two things I want to thank everyone that shared their stories and our host, Chris, and also the staff for putting this together and all the funders. The connections to continue. So one connection was with StoryWorks. My oldest son was one of the participants a couple years ago. So I was very pleased to hear Reagan speak this evening. So thank you for giving the students and the different people in the state that opportunity to share their stories. And for the honor of hearing the daughter and granddaughter of the most respected Dr. Elaine Ramos. I found out that she passed a year ago. She had been one of my first professors at the university in Fairbanks in the early 70s. And she left a very strong legacy in her family. And I was very grateful to hear her daughter and her granddaughter speak, her share their stories. Annette and Laurentia, I hope I'm saying your name right, in the stories you shared, there are vast numbers across the state, the nation, and the world who are caregivers. There are many people with taking care of family members, either children or elderly, with cardiovascular, neurological, and any kind of illnesses. And those caregivers work 24/7. And we don't have speakers, as Annette has been for TBI. So thank you so much for being a speaker for and enlightening us and supporting those people, Annette. And for Ken, from our Yupik upbringing, I was taught we never give up. We never give up on a person. We keep hoping and praying. We keep guiding and mentoring. So thank you for your work. Thank you for all that you have motivated and supported. And then Brian, our stories on the Yukon River have not yet been told. All our stories. In the 1800s, all the steamboats that have come up in the Yukon River, our great-grandparents' grandparents have seen steamboats come by up to Fairbanks, bringing gold miners. You know, the stories go on. We haven't heard those stories yet. Those are amazing stories untold yet. And the missionary stories. My mother went to the Akurak Mission, a Catholic mission, on the coast, 60 miles from my home. There's a St. Mary's Catholic. So there's a lot of stories. So connecting with Brian, and I know some of your family members, Melinda Chase. And so thank you for your story also, and reminded me of all these other untold stories. And I think I got everyone. Oh, David, I'm sorry. I know David's parents. Oh, there you are. And so I'm very grateful to them, both your parents, such strong leaders, and your mother for sharing story that she wrote. When I travel across the world, I've been to Aotearoa, New Zealand. I've been to Hawaii. I've been to Canada. And Tewa country, and I ask when I'm there, my children were little, I'd ask, how do I know that these are authentic indigenous stories of the local people that I can take back to my children to tell them of where I've been and what the original people in that region, how they lived? And so David's mother wrote one of the stories of, you know, such a place in our southwest region, Gwichluk, okay. Yeah, Kwethluk, in English, I guess. And then Steve, where are you, Steve? There. I really appreciate your leadership. It takes people to come together to realize that we have basic human needs, that we all can help each other. And for the vast state that we have in Alaska, with the vast regions, the over 200 villages not connected by road, to bring people together to understand the lifestyle there to the lifestyle here, to see that there are hopes and dreams that can make the quality of life better for everyone through programs like this. So we really appreciate your leadership, Oriana. And I want to take a moment to challenge you. If you don't know where any of these villages are, like Anvik, where Brian's from, Yakutat, where Christina and Charmaine and Nirvana are from, Mountain Village, that'll be your homework. And the next time someone asks you in an audience like this, where is Mountain Village, you can raise your hand and you'll know where it is. And you'll know a little bit more about that it's in the Yupik region. I want to take a moment and just feel the presence of the indigenous people from this region from the earliest on, from the 1700s to the 1800s, the Dena'ina people, fishing right along the Ship Creek, fish camps all up and down. And their ways and many of Alaska's indigenous people's ways have survived to today. The fishing, the hunting, the ways to be good human people. All those have continued on today. So we thank all our ancestors, we thank all the good people today for all your work. And I'm only my third year as a board member, and I'm still learning about the humanities and all the wonderful programs that are housed at the humanities and the great staff that continue to do our work on our programs. Koyana.
Thank you for listening to Addressing Alaskans today on Alaska Public Media. We've been listening to an event titled Here and Now 907 Stories of Leadership that took place on June 21st and was hosted by the Alaska Humanities Forum. To hear a longer version of this program, you can refer to our webpage at alaskapublic.org. I'm your host and producer for today's program, Eric Bork, for KSKA Anchorage.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.